listening
to the CD Baby.
CD Baby.
CD Baby.
DIY.
Musician.
Musician Podcast.
Hey there, and welcome to episode number 142 of the CD Baby DIY Musician Podcast. My name is Kevin, and joining me for this roundtable edition is Chris, and for the final podcast appearance, The Bolt. How
Hello.
You guys doing?
Hey.
Well, since I threw it out there, we should probably discuss the biggest news item in our podcast, and is that The Bolt is moving on from the world of CD Baby, and you're headed to do some marketing for your brother's company that's been exploding. So why don't you tell us a little bit about it?
I'm sad to leave CD Baby. I've been here for 8 years, if you can believe it. And my brother has this great web design and a company here in Portland, and it's been growing like crazy, and it'll be a really cool opportunity for me to sort of build out the digital marketing side of his company, Murmur Creative.
Yeah, so you're going to be leaving next week, and this will be your last official appearance on the podcast. You never know, we might have a guest appearance in the future.
Yeah, don't rub off the bullet yet. Who knows?
I have a conspiracy theory I just thought of. Basically, you and your brother are kind of like the heart and soul of the band Nervous and a Kid. So yeah. Are you really just kind of just going to be having band practice all the time?
That's right.
I know. You know, we're really joined at the hip because we play in a band together, we live together, and now we're going into business together.
And you guys do look a lot alike, too. So yeah, so you will be missed. You've had a long stand here on the podcast. First is Charles, then is, I don't know what else you've been called on this.
Well, no, I think it started out as Robert.
Oh, yeah, that's right. It was Robert and then Charles.
Charles is my middle name, and I think that's what we were when we first started the podcast. We're like, oh, you can just go by your middle name, Charles, so that there's not confusion between the two Chris's. But then at the last minute, I was like, no, I want to be Robert.
And then I think, was it your mom was like, why are you being called Robert on this podcast?
I know.
So then you moved to Charles, and then that just felt weird. So. Randomly, I don't even know how it came about.
I was just going to go as my last name, and I was like, why didn't I just do that from the beginning? Just go as Bolton. And once we revealed that I was going to go by Bolton and my first name was really Chris, then our longtime listener, Mr. Billy, wrote a whole song about my name changes, and then he said that I should just go as the Bolt.
And Mr. And Billy to thank. All right.
Yeah, and that's why I became the Bolt after that.
Yep. So and here you are, and you'll leave us as the Bolt. Well,
wait, there's still time for one last name change.
That's true.
Yeah, I don't know what that would be though. You're just for the rest of the episode, you guys could call me Frank. I don't know.
Well, you will be missed. You do a lot of work on the podcast that listeners may not know. The three of us were there from the beginning, but I know that we started the podcast based on both you and I were really into podcasts at the time and just wanting to get one going for CD Baby, and we brought Chris in to get some artistic credibility to the show, so
which I have yet to bring.
Yeah, but anyway, your contribution has been much appreciated, and I will miss having you on the show, and I know our artists and listeners will as well, and I no longer have anybody to go, hey man, can you get this posted by noon today?
But
so people thought the podcast was irregular. Now, just wait.
Yeah, you know, I am online in various places though. If you wanna catch up, I'm on Twitter at searchpdx.
All right. Well, the show must go on, and we will try to make it through with as few tears today as possible. But let's move on and let's get into some news.
CD Baby.
Music. News.
Well, lots of news happening in the last couple weeks, but we're going to dive into some of the bigger headlines and some of the more interesting developments. Pandora has opened its long-anticipated analytics platform, Pandora Amp, to all artists and managers. The free service provides a detailed view of the audiences for the 125,000 plus artists on the hugely popular online radio service. Derived from tens of billions of hours of personalized listening, Pandora hopes that AMP will help artists, most of whom never received traditional broadcast radio play, to make decisions about touring, single selection, set list, audience, targeting, and more. You can sign up to get your account or get your artist profile, claim your artist profile, I should say, at amp.pandora.com. And I will say that there are some hoops that you need to jump through in order to get this accomplished. So this could be big. I think this is something that could help Pandora's image problem.
I'm scared to go and look and see how many thumbs down some of my songs have had.
I don't, you know, that's the thing. I've been trying to, this just happened a couple days ago, and there is some hoops that in fact, right as we were starting to record this podcast, I got another email from them and letting me know that there was one more hoop I needed to jump through. So basically, when you go to sign up, it asks you to sign into your Pandora account. Well, I don't have a banned Pandora account. I don't listen to Pandora as a band. So I had to use my personal email address and sign in, and I did that, and it asked me to claim the account, the artist, search the artist and claim it, and I did. And then it sends you an email, and you have to then provide, you have to use an official contact email address that is visible on the official band web page. So I had to go add the email address that was visible on the web page and then email them from that email account. Well, then the email I just got was saying that I needed to go back and sign up an official Pandora, user account with that email address. So I'm like, really? So now I'm going to have two Pandora accounts, one that I use for listening, and one, the only reason I have it is to log in as a band. So those are the hoops you got to jump through. So far, I have not made it into an account yet, so I don't know if they have thumbs up or thumbs down information or anything yet. So if anyone has made it into an account, feel free to email or call us and let us know what you think. But it could be an interesting development. Moving on, a report compiled by Ipsos Media gives an interesting glimpse into the average consumer's knowledge of various digital services. So these numbers I'm about to read are people, percentages of average consumers that have not heard of the service. So Vivo, over 60% of consumers have not heard of Vivo. Deezer was about 60%, which is just new here in the US. Spotify, just over 40% of consumers have not heard of Spotify. Amazon MP3 was just under 40%. iTunes was about 25%. And YouTube, only about 10% of consumers out there had not heard of YouTube. So about 90% of the people out there know about YouTube, and about 75% know of iTunes. So I thought that was an interesting statistic there.
How does anyone not know about YouTube?
Well, they're probably 2 years old or like 97 years old.
<That's>... And the two-year-old just didn't know that that's the service they'd been using.
Yeah, I wonder how do they define consumer? Is that like someone 18 and up or something?
Yeah,
like that?
I tried to find some more details on that to figure out exactly who they surveyed. I didn't find that before the recording of the podcast. But the interesting thing is that, if we just take it as, for face value, not a big surprise here. I think some folks might be surprised to find that 40% of people don't know about Amazon MP3 or Spotify. To me, you know, Amazon MP3 is kind of buried in the service, so that's not too shocking to me. And if you're not an Android user, you might not use Amazon MP3, because I think they tie into Android better. I could be wrong. I use an iPhone. Spotify, you know, streaming services, that makes sense to me. But, you know, I think really what it points to is the value of getting your music on YouTube, that everybody's going to YouTube and searching. That's really the number one streaming music site, is YouTube. So to me, that's what that points to, and why that kind of report was interesting.
What stands out to me is that there are 25% of consumers are living under a rock. I mean, how do you not know about YouTube? All right, I'll shut up.
No, 10%. 10% had not.
Oh, 10%. Okay.
Well, you figure in people above a certain age that are pre-internet era, you know, they wouldn't have surveyed kids, so that doesn't matter. But yeah, you know, there's people that don't use the internet. I've met some. They're interesting. Speaking of YouTube just announced that they have reached a big milestone, a $1 billion milestone in payments to companies that take part in its Content ID program. Content ID, which was set up in 2007, allows companies to put advertising on fan-generated video clips rather than take them down for copyright infringement. Videos include excerpts from TV shows and, for our, you know, our interest, songs. If you're still not getting a piece of the YouTube action, YouTube monetization comes free with your standard or pro distribution package through CD Baby. And I have to say, we are seeing massive amounts of money ramping up that we're paying out to artists. So if you have yet to tap into this, you can log into your CD Baby account and opt in your tracks immediately. But yeah, $1 billion paid out through YouTube. It's a lot of money.
And how much have we paid out? I remember our last announcement was when we'd hit above a million, but that was quite a while ago.
It's ramping up quite nicely. We should have another announcement shortly. I don't have all the final numbers, but our next payment is coming up, and it is turning into some real cash to artists. And the interesting thing is, a lot of artists will say, well, you know, I haven't put my music up on YouTube. It's surprising how much music is on YouTube and in videos, random videos that you never thought would have your music, and you can start making money off of those. Even if you're thinking, I just make music and I've put a couple tracks up on SoundCloud, or I have an album through distribution, hasn't sold much, still opt in, because again, it's amazing. It's not just from my experience, it's so many artists we deal with, how much music has made its way onto YouTube in the weirdest and strangest places, and you can make money from that.
I found someone maybe a month or two ago that had actually made a music video for one of my songs and had never told me. So I was like, I wonder, I was uploading some album art videos, and I was like, did I already upload this one? So I did a search for it, and then I found this music video someone had made. I'm like, that's odd. I mean, it was not odd that they did it, just odd I never heard about it.
Yeah, that's a perfect example, and I think that happens more than people realize. Someone's a fan of an artist, and they throw it in a vacation video, or they do something like that, which you would think that if someone's going to go through the trouble of making a music video with your song, they might, hey, check this out, you know. But it happens a lot, and so it's worth getting into, and I only see that number growing in a big, big way. All right, finally, during a recent Facebook chat, YouTube issues an official apology straight from Bono's mouth. And during the chat, one fan asked Tuesday, can you please never release an album on iTunes that automatically downloads to people's playlist ever again? It's really rude. And Bono's response was, oops, I'm sorry about that. This beautiful idea, we kind of got carried away with it. He continued, artists are prone to that kind of thing. Drop of megalomania, touch of generosity, dash of self-promotion, and deep fear that these songs that we poured our life into over the last few years might not be heard. There's a lot of noise out there. I guess we got a little noisy ourselves to get through it. So there you have it. official apology.
Now, do you think he was sincere in that apology, or behind that was he really saying, you ungrateful?
That's what I'm thinking. First of all, let's back up. A fan asked him this. Now, if I have an opportunity to talk to Bono and I have like one question, I get one opportunity to say something to him, that is the last thing I'm going to bring up. I might ask something, you know, insightful, something I've been wanting to know about the band, not take it as a moment to complain to them for one of the greatest bands to ever live to give me an album for free. So anyway, official apology. We talked about it before. And the interesting thing, though, that I find from his quotes from about giving it away in the first place and also in this apology is that, you know, no matter how big you get, I think if you are truly an artist and not just something that's in a corporate machine, although I'm sure somebody might argue with me about you two on this, but I find them to be true artists, that there is that fear that this album that I spent 2 years of my life working on, that no one's going to hear it, and that's a bummer. And so I would say that if I was in the same position where Apple is asking me if I want to give the album away to everybody, I'm saying yes every time.
How many people actually downloaded it?
The last numbers they issued, and this was a couple weeks ago, was like 29 million, I believe.
Wow. And so even though that was probably less than 10% or something of iTunes users, it's still a huge number.
Yeah, it's massive. I mean, there was several numbers floating around. There was numbers of people that had experienced it in some way, and then numbers of people that had actually downloaded it. The 29 million might have been experienced it in some way. I could be wrong. I don't have those in front of me. But it was a lot. Either way, both numbers were a lot. And it, by experienced it, they meant that had streamed it on Beats Music or I don't know if it's on iTunes Radio, but or had downloaded it and listened to it. So that's they were including Beats Radio or Beats's streams in that experienced it number. So you know,
I was picturing the experience to be that they listen to the first track and then they delete the whole album.
It just depends on how they crunch those numbers.
Do you guys remember when MP3 players, and I think this even happened when you bought like a Dell computer or something, you would get like a couple of promo albums? Like I remember
How dare they?
I know.
That's my hard drive space.
I think there was a David Byrne album on one of those.
Yep, there was. Yeah, I got that.
Yeah, they used to do that all the time, especially before the iPod, that they would come preloaded with like 10 albums. And I think actually, I believe once the iPod took off, that a lot of the other companies were trying to like load it with a ton of music. And part of the appeal was that you were going to get sort of instant catalog.
I had one of my songs in iTunes on the demo models of some Apple computers at the Apple stores, but I'm pretty sure when you actually bought the thing, they wiped it. So,
Yeah, that's kind of. But back then, you know, it wasn't. If I deleted it, it wasn't because I didn't like it. It was more of like, I can only hold 10 albums on this MP3 player, so that's all I can. I gotta delete something. So, anyway,
and that may have been some of the.
Wait, what? Go ahead.
I was going to say that may be one of the reasons that some people were teed off is that they have only got so much room on their phone and someone downloaded a bunch of MP3s.
Yeah. But when I sit back and think about all the world's troubles these days and what might
Should
get me...
Should you be out solving them? That's what they do, right? They solve the world's problems.
Yeah. So but anyway, I know I've made a couple people mad with my... editorializing about all I can say is Bono, apology officially accepted. I think it's a great album. If you deleted it, go back and get it. It's a really good album. I like it more and more the more I listen to it. I'm proud of you, Bono. Stick to your guns. All right, let's move on. We got lots more to talk about and some calls that later on in the show. So the Bolt, I threw it out there to him to pick the final discussion topic for this episode. And so why don't you set it up and let's get talking.
Okay, something that I've talked, I know I've talked to you about it a lot, Kevin, and it's something that's really impressed me was this Kickstarter campaign for The Coolest. And if you don't know what The Coolest is, it's a cooler, like a cooler that you put cold, icy beverages in that has been enhanced with all these gadgets. It's like the Inspector Gadget cooler that this guy came up with. And it went wild on Kickstarter. I think that his goal was maybe like $50,000 to raise to help manufacture the cooler, and he ended up raising over $13 million.
Yeah, it was crazy, crazy successful.
And they had this video that they made about the cooler, and it went viral. And tons of people bought it, bought the cooler, because part of the Kickstarter campaign was you could spend, it was like $170 or $80, you could pay up front for a Coolest cooler. And the reason why this Kickstarter campaign really struck with me is because it was so successful, and so many, you know, Kickstarter campaigns, so many crowdfunding campaigns can just be a pain. They can feel like, you know, like you're just doing everything and you're just not getting the backers that you need.
And I wouldn't know anything about that.
And I know Kevin's in the middle of a crowdfunding campaign, and he's been pulling his hair out about it. And I wanted to, like, what do bands need to do to be successful? And even, you know, obviously, there's no perfect recipe for success, but I wanted to look at a campaign that was really successful, even though it's not for music, and sort of see what we could pull from it. You know, what sort of ideas and techniques and marketing ideas could we get out of that campaign and then possibly apply to a crowdfunding campaign that we did for our own music.
All right.
The way that I decided we could do this is by looking at Dr. Cialdini's Six Principles of Influence. Dr. Cialdini is a psychologist who wrote this book and came up with these six principles, basically marketing principles, that apparently any old marketer or, you know, musician can apply to enhance the effectiveness of their campaigns. So I figured I could just go through all six, and we could sort of think about, like, how is this principle used by The Coolest in selling that cooler, and how could a band use it, that principle, to enhance their crowdfunding campaigns.
All right. So you're just going to go down the list.
Go ahead, Chris.
Oh, you want to look at these things in relation to the crowdfunding video or the entire campaign?
Both. I think the video is what made the campaign. So I think that you may want to pause the podcast and go watch the video real quick. Just type in The Coolest Kickstarter into Google and you can watch the video. It's only a couple minutes long. But you don't have to watch it. You'll probably get most of the principles. But the idea is that this guy has created this cooler that has all these features. It has a built-in light. It has a built-in bottle opener. It has a built-in speaker that you can tether your phone to and play music. It has a built-in blender. It's basically this Inspector Gadget cooler that just really resonated with people. They're like, you know, he starts out the video and he's like, the cooler hasn't been updated in years. Like, it just holds ice. That's all it does. He's like, check out The Coolest. You know, now we've got this cooler that can do everything you need at your tailgate party or at the beach or, you know. And it is really full-featured, pretty cool-looking cooler.
All right, so why don't you just dive right into your list, and then we can chat afterwards.
Okay. So, Dr. Cialdini, Six Principles of Influence. The first one is reciprocation. And as far as the as reciprocation goes, and the video and the coolest campaign is you're basically given this really entertaining video, and you can share this with your friends, and you can tell the story of the coolest to your friends. And in a way, you feel sort of indebted to the fact that you've received this sort of insider knowledge about a product that not many people have heard about, that is basically been an entertaining story that you can share with your friends. So in a way, you feel indebted to coming across the content itself and being able to share it with other people. I think that the way that bands could do this is by giving away certain perks, giving free stuff, free access to things, or spending time like writing emails to fans. Anything that you do sort of honestly and generously for your fans is going to make them feel indebted to you, and it's going to cause them to want to reciprocate. So something, if you can give away something free, or give, and that can be your attention or your love or whatever, you're going to have a better chance with your crowdfunding campaign getting people come back and returning the favor.
It seems like another thing that was wrapped up in reciprocation with the coolest was that it's a product for letting people have a good time more easily.
And right.
The video itself not only represents that, but becomes a way of having a good time. Like, it's kind of a fun video to watch, and then when you say, like, you feel indebted, like you've enjoyed the video, so you want to share it, then suddenly you're giving other people a good time. It's like this, I don't know, tumbling effect of feel goodness or something like that.
Exactly, exactly. And I think that, you know, creating content like that that people like to share is one way of using reciprocation. So number two, principles of influence, is social proof. And social proof just means that, you know, your friends and people that you know have sort of endorsed the product. And, you know, this video went viral. When your mom and your brother and your coworker are all sharing the same video, it gives the product some serious heft. You know, I think that the same thing goes for music. When people at your office, when people at home, when your friends are talking about some music that they like, then you might go and check that out, or you might go buy the album. You know, some listeners may go re-download that U2 album because Kevin mentioned it in this podcast. That's a perfect example of social proof. It's also an example of authority, but we'll get to that one.
Is social proof something, this is probably a rhetorical question, but social proof something you can encourage throughout the campaign as opposed to just creating, an initial burst in video that stirs it up? I'm wondering what ways you can, like,
well, I think that
stoke the fire.
Testimonials is a good example in your Kickstarter campaign, or I keep on saying Kickstarter, but it could be any crowdfunding campaign. If you get fans talking about, I guess that, you know, a lot of times you think of social proof. I mean, social proof doesn't have to be, you know, like somebody you know. It could just be a person who you identify with who is giving a good review of a product. You know, that's why reviews on Amazon and iTunes and stuff like that work. So I think that you can get social proof by featuring things that your fans say about your music and about the, you know, about the crowdfunding experience and about other things that might endear you and your music to potential new fans.
Kevin, have you, if someone donates to your Pledge Music campaign, what do you guys do to try and get them then to, like, share the news or share?
Oh, that's a tough one. I mean, Pledge has some stuff that's built in that tries to encourage it. And some people have set it to be automated you know, when they do something, it'll automatically tweet something, or when we post a new update, they automatically tweet and post. But as far as getting testimonials, I mean, that's you know, that I think that's a good idea. Or getting some recent reviews. Did I do it? No, I probably should have done it. Add it to the list of the 1,000 things you have to do when running a fan funded campaign. And I'm slowly working through that list. By the time the project is done, I will hopefully make it through most of those.
So the third principle of influence is commitment and consistency. Okay, so once we've committed to something, once we've shared a video, once we've even watched a video, that's a commitment right there, 2 minutes of your time. We feel a certain amount of allegiance. You know, we don't want to back out. We don't want to, in a way, once you've committed to something and you back out, it's a failure. So once you share a video or talk to, you know, tell your friend about something, you're more likely to commit to, you know, a donation or a purchase or some other sort of commitment to the product or to the music that you've created a relationship with. So I think that with the, you know, with the coolest, people were talking about it, they were sharing it on social media, and in the end they donated to it or they bought one because they had been talking it up so much that they would have felt as if they hadn't. And I think that you can operate on this principle with your fans as well by getting your fans to commit to small things. You know, it might be hard to get them to commit to $50 or $1,000 or a package where they meet the band, you know, but if you can get a very small commitment and then work on them throughout the rest of the campaign, they're going to be more likely to donate again because they've already made a certain amount of investment in the success of the campaign. You know, you feel once you've donated a dollar, you're like, oh, I'm a part of this. And if the band gets closer and closer to their goal and it's $5 or $10 or $100 they need, you're probably going to be more likely to donate again.
I think the interesting thing to me is looking at the patterns of fans. You know, we are in our final week of our Pledge Music campaign. So if there's anybody out there that would like to make, join in and pledge, pre-order the album. We're still, the doors are still open. But the thing that's interesting to me is that people will like every post that we say about it. They'll share tons of, you know, they'll like the video, they'll like the all the photos from the studio, all our kind of dialogue about what we're up to and all the updates that we've been posting to the Pledge Music campaign. They'll go and like all of those, but they still don't actually go and just get the pre-order for $10.
Right. Well, and that guess maybe the commitment is too small. Maybe it's so easy just to click like that they don't feel committed.
Yeah, maybe so. It's just an interesting thing with social media that I think with, especially things like buying the music and or supporting a fan-funded campaign, how often people will just like or comment and weigh in, like, I can't wait to hear the music, but I'm like, I can't wait for you to actually do that pre-order. But, you know, it's been something that artists have dealt with for years. I mean, working here at CD Baby, we get phone calls from artists all the time. All my friends say they love the new album, or I got all these likes online, and they said they clicked through, but I'm not seeing any sales. I'm like, that's because your friends aren't buying. They're just telling you.
Because your friends are jerks.
You need to get new friends. That's what that happens a lot. I mean, people will do that all the time. I can't wait to get your album. Well, here's the link. Cool. I can't wait to get your album, you know, and they don't actually do it. You know, it's interesting. I think what brings to mind to me is how you get in a world of social media, how you push those people over the edge without just turning into someone who's a raving lunatic on social media, just saying the same thing over and over again.
Yeah. So the fourth principle of influence is scarce. And I'm sure most people sort of understand this idea, you know.
Can you say it again? I don't think people heard. You said number four.
Okay. Kind of. Scarcity is the fourth principle. So the idea that whatever you're offering, your music, your product, is not available everywhere, and it might run out. So one of the ways that the Coolist is able to do this is that, you know, it's a Kickstarter campaign. The only place in the world you're going to be able to get this Coolist cooler is through Kickstarter, and the campaign's going to end. You know, like you've got to act within a certain time period, and you've got to you've got to do it through Kickstarter. And once you have this product, you're going to be fairly unique. You know, you're going to have something that not many other people have. You're going to have a conversation piece at every barbecue you go to for the next 10 years, you know? And that's a really high value. You know, how many albums can you say have that sort of value that, you know, when people come over to your house, you're like, oh man, you got to check this out. And there are albums like that. You know, there are, you know, beautifully done, amazing, you know, vinyl albums that have, you know, unique artwork, or are, you know, packaged in an interesting way, or have, you know, like some songs that nobody else has heard. You know, I mean, very often we see an albums released with bonus songs and things like that. Any sort of rarity that you can give to the music that you're releasing is going to help it sell. And, you know, this is built into the fabric of a lot of Kickstarter and crowdfunding campaigns, where you offer packages that don't just include your music, but also include unique experiences like meeting the band in person, going to lunch with certain band members, that sort of thing, having a concert in your home with the band. Those sort of really unique perks really drive crowdfunding campaigns.
Yeah, I think this is, you know, if you're putting together a campaign, a fan-funded, crowd-funded campaign, this is important to kind of think about, what do we have that we can offer that could be a unique item just for this campaign? And we kind of hit that in the middle of our campaign with Pledge Music. And the thing I love about Pledge Music is that there you can make adjustments as you go. They give you a rep that's helping you all along the way to optimize your campaign. Where that's why in the past when I did a fan-funded campaign, I felt kind of like, whenever I hit submit, I can't make any changes and that's it. And if I come up with a better idea halfway through this, I'm stuck. But we were kind of in the situation of like, kind of, you know, the mid point of the campaign going, man, how do we get a little bit of life in this? What can we offer? And we were going through all the archives of stuff we had, and I came across a song idea tape of all the song ideas that we had going into our second record. And our second record sold quite well, so we thought there would be folks that would be interested in hearing the beginnings of that, all those songs, and a lot of song ideas that didn't get recorded. So we offered that up as something that's an exclusive, will only be available on this campaign, and will probably never make it available ever again. And so people started buying it, got a lot of interest, and it was also something that we posted a photo of it like 2 months ago, that people were like, how do I get a copy of that? I'd love to get a copy of that. And so now we're just in trying to get those folks to have those words be meaningful.
It's interesting that, like, with a crowdfunding campaign, it's the perfect place where you get to throw in those scarce items in relationship to this other item, your album or your single or whatever, which you hope is anything but scarce. Like, usually you want to get this thing to a place where you can sell, you know, 10,000 copies or 100,000 copies. You want it to go everywhere. But along with that, in order to help that happen, you come up with all these, you know, limited edition things. I think it's really exciting that you get to sort of have both things happening at once with crowdfunding.
Yeah, and it's interesting because like that demo tape thing, I think if we just randomly released it outside of a project like this, it wouldn't make sense. It would just be kind of like, huh? It's kind of weird or random. I think it would feel random. But in the process of, you know, how we kind of, when we originally posted a photo online, is like, hey, we've been going through all the archives as we've been like finding cool stuff to give people. Because you know, we've been posting a lot of like live tracks that people hadn't heard for the people that had contributed. And you know, so it was like, hey, here's this demo tape. And it took a photo and people were like, I want a copy. And so I'm like, okay, we can put it up on the Pledge Music campaign. And so that's kind of one of the cool things about using Pledge is that it becomes this dynamic thing where you can kind of react to what's working with fans and kind of keep tailoring things in the campaign as you reach the end to you know, do what they want. Had we used Kickstarter, we wouldn't have been able to do any of that, and we would have probably not be where we're at right now with the campaign just because we would have been stuck into some things and not had any advice. So
number five is liking or likability. And this is a pretty simple concept, is you want to be likable. You want people to identify with you and feel in a way, generous. I think one of the ways to influence generosity and likability is by being generous yourself. I think that bands that are really closed off, that are very into their own image and not very tuned into their fans, are for the most part going to do pretty bad at crowdfunding campaigns. But I think that if you are generous and you talk to your audience and you give to your fans, people are going to think that you're likable. If you show your humanness and don't hide too much behind image and poise, you're going to be likable and people are going to be more likely to contribute to your campaign. I think that in the coolest video, Ryan Grepper, the guy who did the video, he's very likable. He's like casual. He's like wearing shorts. He's talking about how you can have a better time when you buy his product. And I think he succeeds in being rather likable.
Plus, he had a cooler full of beer, so.
Yeah, yeah, and that makes you likable.
Yeah. Maybe that should be a reward on your next crowdfunding campaign.
Cooler full of beer. That might break some laws.
Well, if you just come over to their house as a band with a cooler full of beer, you know.
That would be awesome.
And the number six is authority. Authority means that someone with expertise or a position of power endorses your product. This I didn't really see. I don't know if you guys see the principle of authority happening in the coolest product. You know, the video, it didn't really contain any sort of celebrity endorsements or you know, experts on anything. I guess you could argue that Ryan Grepper is an expert on the coolest because he invented it.
He does kind of set up his expertise by saying in the video, you know, I'm an inventor of products. I have this history of making things just like this.
Oh,
here's
you're right.
My newest one. You know, whether you believe him or not is, I did, but.
No, that's totally it. I didn't even think about that. He does. He's like, I'm an inventor of products. And this is not the only one, but this is the coolest. And, you know, the way I was thinking about this in relation to bands is that, you know, using musicians in your community that are maybe more well-known, that have influence, people that are respected for their expertise, give you endorsements, you know, like to have, if you're going to make a Kickstarter video or a crowdfunding video, like why not have some person of authority like talk about why your music is great. It's actually probably a little bit more flattering, you know, to have someone else besides yourself like tooting your own horn. It probably can be more effective having someone who seems like they have a little bit of clout talking sincerely about how great your music is.
I had you know, I'm this never-ending project that I have that eventually will come out as an album. But I've been putting together pieces for a crowdfunding campaign, and I had the producer of the album I asked him some questions, asked him to answer some questions on video, and he did, and he said really, you know, flattering things, and I'm like, thank God, now I don't have to do that myself on camera. Like, this guy took care of all that, because I would be terrible at it anyways. You know, I don't mind being on camera asking for help. I just don't want to be on camera, like, telling you how great my music is, so.
Right, right. And, you know, what we've learned about marketing over the years is that, you know, when you do just talk about yourself or talk about your own product, and you forget that you're actually need to talk to your audience and about what your product is going to give them, you end up losing out. One of the great things about the coolest video is that it shows very in a lot of detail, like all the cool things you can do with it, you know, so you're watching the video being like, oh, that would be so cool that if I had a cooler at the campfire at night that, you know, and a little LED light lights up so I can see what's in the cooler, you know, just like little things like that. And you're like, oh, that would be such a great advantage. Or, you know, it has this little bungee cord ridge on it so that you can strap stuff to the top of it when you're walking down to the beach or whatever. These are all things where you're like, oh, that would be cool for me.
That reminds me of another thing I found interesting about that video where he said, like, I want the coolest to be so cool that it's not just meeting you like your existing need for barbecues and camping stuff, but it'll make you want to do those things more, which would kind of be like what you would hope from a music campaign. Like, I hope that something about this campaign, something about our music, you know, makes you want to listen to it all the time, or maybe gets you into a new genre of music or something that's like inspiring beyond just here's this product that I hope meets your need.
Yeah, that's a great idea. I mean, sort of, yeah, like this, I hopefully this music just doesn't inspire you in itself. It also inspires you to go out and listen to more music or mm-hmm. discover, listen to things in new ways.
Right. That's a lot easier said than done, but.
Right.
Any other thoughts about how your obsession with the coolest relates back to artists and their music?
Well, I mean,
everyone should just make the coolest one of their fan funding campaign items.
The coolest has a really great video, and that's kind of at the center of it. And that's why we keep on referring to it. It's a cool product, but they had a really good video, and I think that with any crowdfunding campaign, you need to have a really good video. And they actually, I think the coolest video that is a part of the campaign now, they made one originally and they decided it wasn't good enough, so then they remade it. And I think that they understood how powerful having a really good video is to a crowdfunding campaign.
Yeah, I would say it's pretty key. And if you don't have one, you should probably not do your campaign until you get one. I know that the video piece is something that a lot of people struggle with. The fan funding campaign I did for Hello Morning, it ended up being kind of awkward because it was just kind of me doing most of the video, and I'm not the front man. I'm obviously the guy that is a marketer, but I'm not the front man, and trying to get them on video was tough, and especially without, you know, like leading out and saying, this is what we're trying to do, and not feeling sheepish and awkward, because if you do that on video, people are just going to feel like they're not going to feel inspired, or it's going to make them feel kind of weird and not want to jump in with what you're doing. So you don't have to be goofy and a comedian, but you got to be confident in what you're saying and know, you know, look at the videos. This is representing who we are and what we want people to do. How does it relate? How do people feel after they've watched it?
Yep.
All right. Thanks for putting that all together. You will be missed on the podcast. But before you go, we have some...
Oh, and I should probably say we'll put links on the cdbabypodcast.com podcast episode to both the six rules of influence and a link to the coolest campaign so people can check those things out.
All right. Cool. Well, for your last podcast, we do have some phone calls, and one of them taps into your expertise. So let's get to those now.
Hello. Hey, thanks for all you guys do. I have a question I've been searching for the past few hours to answer the answer to this. This is about the requirement for a sync license. If someone does a cover version, if I were to do a cover version of a song and upload it to YouTube without a video, just with a static black screen, so there is no video, does that require a sync license as well? And is it the same case if it doesn't? If I were to Photoshop some sort of graphic, especially for the cover version of the song, and have that be displaying the whole time but not moving at all, would that require a sync license if in the former case it doesn't? Very confused about this. Okay, thanks, guys. Bye.
Well, thanks for the call. He didn't leave his name on that one, but a question that a lot of artists ask, whether or not they need a sync license for YouTube, and also what constitutes sort of a video on YouTube. His scenario was that he was just uploading a song with just a black image, so the screen looks blank, if that still counts as a video. To answer that question, yes, that is still a video, because it's being played in a video format. So whether it's a blank screen or it is a image that you create, a static image, or if it's actual video, if you're uploading it to YouTube, you are uploading a video, because who's to say your black screen is not an artistic choice of video? So yeah, that's still going to count as video. As far as the sync license goes, technically by law, the answer should be yes, but YouTube created their content ID system to kind of get around some of those and create some loopholes. And so technically, yes, but what's going to happen if you upload a cover song to YouTube is that it's going to start having ads appear on it if it gets picked up by the content ID system. If your version of the song is close enough to the original recording that was delivered to YouTube, then it'll get content ID, will pick it up eventually, and they'll just start running ads on it. So unless somebody is being very protective of their catalog, you might get something that says YouTube's removing it because the rights owner wants it removed, but that's highly unlikely. So
unless it's a Prince song, right?
Yeah, actually, so I think they've eased up on that a bit, but anyway, so yeah, that's just, it is a video no matter what you do. If you're uploading something to YouTube, you're creating a video file to do it, and it's going to have a video component. So whatever's on the screen, yep, it constitutes as video. And if you were to use that video elsewhere, you most definitely would need a sync license. Again, technically by law, you should be getting a sync license, but that's not the practice on YouTube. So go ahead.
I was just going to say, if people have more questions about cover songs on YouTube, check out the DIY musician blog over the next month. We've got a LA entertainment attorney that's writing a piece on that exact topic, so check back there.
Yeah, because it is confusing. There's a lot of gray area. There's things that the law states should happen, but currently loopholes are being used to kind of not force the issue. That's sort of what part of the CD Baby sync licensing program. Your music gets on friendlymusic.com, which is intended to be the consumer sync licensing place, so people could go and legally license a song for usage on their, you know, their vacation video or whatever, and they would just be like a dollar or two or $10, and then they would have legally licensed this, created the sync license, and then when they upload it to YouTube, then you would also get sync money. Content ID ad payout money from YouTube monetization, but the usage pattern seems to just be to go to step two and upload without going and get the sync license. And because the content ID is paying out so much, people have been kind of okay with it, but there'll be some, I'm sure, some changes in how things work sometime in the future. So who knows how far in the future remains to be seen. All right, we got another call, and this one is right up the Bolt's alley.
Hey, guys. Question for your podcast. I'm wondering, do you consider it ethical to take keywords of items that are in the news and put them in as keywords on your website? An example being Colon Blow cereal is coming up to for sale this week, and my band Colon Blow has its own website, obviously, and I didn't know if it would be considered ethical or not to type in, you know, the keywords on the page having to do with Colon Blow or Saturday Night Live or things like that. Anyway, keep up the good work. Like what you guys do. Thanks. Bye.
Basically what he's asking, and he didn't leave his name either. Basically what he was asking is that the ethics of kind of playing off search terms based on other events, people, celebrities, something that's happening that kind of plays off similar names as your band name, where it sounded like his band name is similar to something else that was out there, another person or something, and just if it's ethical to kind of try to get search traffic based on those other people. And the Bolt does SEO, which is search engine optimization for us, so that's why I thought this would be a perfect question for him.
Well, I would say it's totally fine to do. I don't think that there's a moral issue. I think that there's probably there's a lot of sort of useless ways of going about it. You know, if you're trying to steal traffic from another artist and you don't have any value to offer, it's not going to do anybody any good. So even if it's, you know, slightly immoral, like, it's just not going to get you anywhere. Search engines are too smart. I think that the ways that you can sort of piggyback on other traffic in sort of a good ethical way would be like, if you're playing at a venue and that venue's, you know, called Smith's or something like that, and you create an article that's, you know, like best show at Smith's tonight or Friday or whenever, and you try to create an article that capitalizes on people looking for shows that are at this particular venue, and it just has to be your band. Like, there you're offering value for people who are searching for shows at a particular venue by advertising your band, and that to me is like a successful use of keywords and Google. And I think that really you just have to ask yourself, are people who are searching for these keywords going to be happy when they land on my page because you've offered valuable content, or are they going to be unhappy because you sort of tricked them into landing there and there's no value? Now, I would say that making, you know, creating content that capitalizes on keywords but is not very relevant or helpful is not incredibly moral, but I also think it just won't work. So it's a waste of your time.
Yeah, I think that the one thing that, you know, Google has gotten really good at filtering out the garbage links. This used to be a pretty popular tactic years ago where people would just load up their website with fake keywords that had nothing to do with what the site was really about, to try and trick people into getting to their site. For starters, you know, if you're an artist and someone, you know, gets tricked to land on your page, it's not like suddenly they're going to go, oh, wow, I want to check out their music. They're going to go, this isn't what I was looking for, and they're going to leave. And that's why Google doesn't like it, because they want people to do a search and instantly find exactly what they were looking for. And so if you're providing misinformation, you're just going to get ranked lower and lower. I think the long-term detriment to your website can be that, you know, behind the scenes, Google has kind of quality ratings for websites, and it can damage your website and make it harder and harder to find, even when people are searching for you directly, just because they think your site is just kind of a spam site. So
yeah,
it's not recommended.
If you're, you know, if you are playing with Taylor Swift, then make a blog post about that, and maybe it'll rank on some Taylor Swift keywords, and people who land on your blog post will be like, oh, this is a band that's playing with Taylor Swift. I love Taylor Swift. I'll check him out. You know, like, definitely use those things that are happening in your real life. You know, use the bands that you're playing with, use the venues that you're playing at, use the events that you're playing at, to create content that'll be valuable to people who are searching for it. So, you know,
yeah, that's good advice, because it's amazing how many people don't take advantage of that, especially when it comes to like YouTube videos, going back to kind of YouTube stuff. We were playing a venue that I'd never been to before, and so I went online to search YouTube to see if bands had posted videos, to see what the venue looked like and kind of what the sound situation might be, and, you know, the audience situation, just as far as like the room, what it looks like, how much it holds. And it was a major venue. I can't remember if it was here in Portland or up in Seattle, that gets tons of artists, big and small. And when I searched YouTube, there was like only like 5 videos. I'm like, how is this even possible? And it's the most of the time is artists upload a video and it says live performance, and they don't say where it was, who was there. And those are the ways you should be optimizing your website and the content you create to draw in traffic. People that are might be searching for things that are related to what you did. I played a show at this venue. It might be another artist that's looking now. They might want to do a show with you, and like, oh, this band did pretty well at that venue. Maybe I should connect with them. And you know, that's how those things can be useful for you. Or fans kind of searching for other bands that played a certain place, you know.
Yeah, it's really good to reverse engineer basically how someone would find your video or your website or your blog posts online. Like, what would someone be typing into Google to find a video of this venue, or to find a video of your band during, you know, like during a certain month or a certain year? Like, you know, putting the date in your title can be important. Putting the band name in your title is super important. Putting the venue name is super important. Although, you know, think about what people might be searching for and make sure all those details are represented very prominently, especially in the title.
All right. Well, that's all the questions. Thanks for those phone calls. If you'd like to call the podcast, you can do so. Our listener line is 360-524-2209, or you can go to cdbabypodcast.com and check out contact us there, leave a comment in the notes section, or the phone number is listed there as well. Which, by the way, we have a brand new podcast website. It's a theme that's geared more towards podcasting, and that's another thing that The Bolt helped us do. So this will probably be the last theme we ever have, because I'll never be able to figure out how to change the theme on
same website address, still cdbabypodcast.com.
yeah, cdbabypodcast.com. yeah, same web address, same content, just formatted better. So if you actually go to the website, people sometimes go to the website to listen instead of subscribing in iTunes or RSS reader, and it's much easier to download and play and listen. So right from the website, and it's organized better. So yeah. All right. Well, any final words for us?
I'm going to miss you, Bolton.
The Frank signing. Frank.
Frank.
Robert Charles Bolton Frank, we will miss you.
I'll miss you guys too. And, you know, because I do love SEO. If anyone wants to hit me up on Twitter and with SEO questions, I'd be happy to answer. That's at SearchPDX.
For a small fee.
For a small.
Yeah. Follow The Bolt. He'll help you out and give you some pointers about your website. So, cool. I think that's all we have to chat about now. We've got doing some more interviews, so those will be posting shortly. And Chris and I will try to carry the torch and keep it lit and going in that. Absence of The Bolt, but it's hard shoes to fill. So we appreciate all your efforts.
We do have enough episodes now. We could probably just like chop up his voice and then have one of those little keyboard command things. And
Oh, maybe, yeah.
Maybe we'll just have Siri be use the male voice of Siri and ask Siri questions. how do I sell more music, Siri?
Searching.
No. All right. Well, that's going to do it for this episode. We'll catch you next time. See ya.
Adios.
You've been listening to the CD Baby DIY Musician Podcast, broadcasting from Portland, Oregon, USA.